Evelyn Lees from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Well, with the repetitive weather of warm temperatures, clouds, and not much snow, I feel like our avalanche forecast is getting rather repetitive, too. Nothing is really changing. We've got those persistent weak layers in the snowpack, and it's a moderate danger for triggering a slide on a steep mid or upper elevation slope facing west to north through east. There were two new slides yesterday. One was triggered by a cornice drop on purpose, and they were both in Alexander Basin, which is up the Mill Creek drainage or canyon. So, you know, again, there are not a whole lot of places where you could trigger one of these slides, but when you do, they're plenty large enough. This ended up with 5 or 6 feet of debris at the bottom of the slope. The other thing to watch for today is overnight we had an increase in the winds, so there will be a few new wind drifts up along especially the high elevation ridge lines, and then again people should just avoid any sort of a smooth rounded wind drift that are along those upper elevation ridge lines. And other than that, not much change for the future. Moderate danger. Probably the best news is people are finding slightly improved turning conditions in the backcountry. The thin rime crust is breaking down, and people are starting to find some soft snow on northerly facing slopes.
Okay. Evelyn, thank you.
Thank you.
It's 8:12 now, and in the studio with us, Kathy Donnell with Utah State Parks. Good morning.
Good morning. So it's February 1st, and without this much snow, we should start thinking about our summer camping trips. And even if there was snow, we should think about them, because reservations can be made up to 4 months in advance through ReserveAmerica.com. As of today, you can make reservations through June 1st. So Memorial Day weekend is filling up already. With the lack of cold weather, there is no safe ice on the reservoirs at this time, so please stay off the ice if you go to the reservoirs. But the good news is that Deer Creek has officially been declared quagga mussel free by DWR after 3 years of testing with no further evidence, which means the main boat ramp and the island boat ramp are now open. Boaters must still display a signed decontamination form on their dashboard when launching at Deer Creek. Campsites are $20 a night for first come, first serve, with power and sewer hookups available. Portable water can be found at the dump station. Extra vehicles must pay the day use fee. Charleston day use area is a day use only area with no boat launching at this time. Park management will review the recreation usage plan to determine the best use for Charleston day use area in the spring. At Wasatch Mountain State Park, the park is open but has very little snow. The cross-country ski trail is still closed. Campgrounds are closed, but group areas and cabins are open year-round. Snake Creek and Pine Creek roads are closed to wheeled vehicles. Upcoming events include the tree hike on February 3rd from 10 a.m. to 1, the animal tracking class on February 17th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and the moonlight snowshoe hike scheduled for February 23rd starts at 6:30 p.m., and all of those meet at the visitor center. Wasatch Excursions rents snowmobiles out of Wasatch Mountain State Park. You can have a guided or unguided tour leaving directly from the park trailhead. They cater to small to large groups, as well as beginners to expert riders. Jordanelle State Park, the ice fishing tournament has been canceled due to lack of ice. There is some thin ice at Rock Cliff, but please stay off the ice. Camping is allowed at the marina parking lot for $16 a night with a heated restroom but no hookups or showers. Six hike-in campsites are open at Rock Cliff for $10 a night with a porta potty. Day use is now $7 per vehicle, $4 for Utah seniors. Fees have been waived at Ross Creek as there is no winter maintenance there. Applications for the sealed bid process for boat slips are due by February 9th. Jordanelle is now accepting 2018 dates for the Hailstone Event Center. And Rockport has primitive campgrounds open for the winter. Juniper Campground is open but has no hookups. The Tagged Fish Challenge has kicked off and will run through February 28th. 25 tags out of 150 tags have been turned in, and already with two being the grand prize winners. If anyone catches a tagged fish, bring it to the ranger to collect your prize. Fishermen are having success using garlic and cheese power bait. East Canyon has their cabins and yurts open and can be reserved through Reserve America, and the Dixie Campground is also open. Remember to go to make your camping reservations for the summer. Go to reserveamerica.com. And all state parks in the area are starting to hire seasonal summer employees. So please inquire at individual parks for more info.
Okay. Kathy, we'll see you next month. Hopefully it's winter back again.
Yes.
It's coming up now on 8:17. Good morning. Well, after last year's snowfall, the Summit County Snowplow crew are probably happy for a break this year, but with such a low snow year, what keeps them busy all winter? Summit County Public Works Director Derek Gradke in the studio to tell us. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So you've been with Summit County for years now. I mean, have you seen anything like this year?
This is pretty barren. We have seen some years where it's pretty light. Last year, I think, was just slightly over normal. I mean, if you go back a ways, but this winter has been challenging.
Yeah, so, I mean, how many times have drivers even been out?
I think they've been out, well, they've been out more than you'd think, because we've had a couple little ones and we go back. I think we've had 10 to 15 excursions if you count back into December.
Okay.
Because we have to kind of count winter as, we have our budget starts in January, but winter really, you know, is October, November through. So anyways, yeah.
Yeah, so you include that even though it's not with the calendar
correct.
Year. Yeah. How much do you budget for snow removal on an annual basis?
So we spend about $250,000, or we budget $250,000 plus on salt. We have salaries, which, you know, basically cover our guys to be there year round. And then overtime is pretty much, it's pretty minimal as far as the budget goes. Probably less than $20,000 is budgeted for the whole year. And certainly last year we used about 50% more overtime than we had budgeted. This year we'll probably stay within our overtime budget. The overall budget stays the same. So when we go over on overtime, then something else doesn't get done.
Mm-hmm. So the crew, I mean, they basically are year round full-time anyway.
Correct.
And then are called out to plow when they need to plow. So how are you keeping them busy now?
So last winter was really tough on equipment. We spent a lot of money on equipment. Our salt budget, we didn't spend it all, but equipment took a big beating. So this year, what we're doing to keep busy is going back and repairing things that are cracked, broken, bent, things that if we had the snow, we would have tried to limp through just because we didn't have the money to spend to fix it. So that's a big chunk of our time right now. We're still going out and filling potholes. The last, little warm spells, we've been able to fix a few potholes. We go out and trim trees, and we're doing a big effort in our shop to make things safer. We're kind of have an OSHA push to get us back into full compliance. So those are the things we're kind of working on.
Mm-hmm. What is it that you needed to comply with?
We're hanging fire extinguishers and painting around them to make sure that we're not, stacking stuff around them. It's not like we're out of compliance, but just things to make things safer and better.
Yeah. So not only do they have to know how to drive a plow, they have to know how to fix one too, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Our guys have to do routine maintenance. They don't, we have a mechanic and mechanic tech to do the, oil, lube, the major repairs, but our guys have to, help grease them and fix the plows, fix the spreaders when they fail and change hoses and things like that. So.
Yeah. And so what about the salt order? It's hard to believe you spent $250,000 on salt.
That's what's budgeted. Even last winter, we didn't quite spend the whole $2.25, but that's what's budgeted just in case. That's one where if we do go over, we really don't have any other place to steal the money for to fill the bin. That's the other thing that we're doing this year. We've acquired a piece of equipment that allows us to go get our own salt. Usually in the fall when it's raining, our guys will hook up the, dump trucks and their trailer pups, and they'll go down and get our salt. And we fill our bin as much as we can. And then typically, like last winter, We had contracted with a contractor to basically bring us salt every day. This year we have a new trailer, and we're able to almost keep up with our needs by hauling it ourselves, and so we save half the price of having somebody bring it to us.
Yeah, and then how well is it protected? Well, I mean, as we all know, you know, a little bit of water and salt, and you have no more salt.
Correct. Yeah.
So how is it protected?
We have a bin where it's covered. It's actually required by our environmental quality through the state to have it covered.
Yeah, yeah. So have you had to lay off anybody?
No. We basically balance, summer, winter with the crew that we have. We still are one position short that we haven't filled. Well, we've advertised a few times, and we just don't pay enough to attract the right people or to fill that spot. So we were down four early in the winter in 17. Now we're just down one. So
yeah, I'm surprised by that. I mean, because you offer pretty good benefits and retirement, and it's just the hourly that people can't live on.
The construction environment is such that it's tough to attract employees right now.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the spring ahead. What are you planning now for some of the public work projects later this year?
So we're going to do quite a bit of overlay and chip seal projects and slurry seals. We probably will spend somewhere in the neighborhood of about $3 million in overlays and another million or so in seal coats. We're going to do overlays in the Highland States area, Pine Brook. We may do a project in Summit Park. We have one budgeted, but we're working with the Reclamation District and Mountain Regional on partnering on when they need to repair their infrastructure, then we do a section of road, and we're still working with those partners to see if that project's going to come to fruition. We got some work in Jeremy Ranch, Park West Village, Ranch Place, Silver Springs, the Sun Peak area, Chalk Creek. Of course, we spend about $300,000 on Chalk Creek Road every year, either doing overlays or chip seals. And then we'll also be working in the Parks Tech Center Drive and in the Silver Creek Industrial Park area. We'll be doing some overlays there. So that's a good chunk of it.
Yeah, that's a lot of the road projects. Anything in terms of major capital projects?
So the major capital that we're working on this year will focus in the Jeremy area. So the Ecker Park and Ride, we're hoping to kick off. We have a discussion with County Council on the 7th. Hopefully they'll give us the nod to get that going. Kilby Road, if the Park and Ride goes, then we'll also be doing a major project on Kilby Road from the Ecker area back to Jeremy. And then, of course, the Jeremy Roundabout project is currently under design. We're hoping to kick it off in 18. That was my goal to finish it in 18, but with some wetland issues and scheduling structures and things like that, we are now hoping that we get started.
Yeah, that's with regard to the Ecker Park and Rides, do we have UDOT's okay on this, huh?
Yeah, we're just finishing the details, signing the agreement. As soon as they, as part of the Park and Ride, we have to reconstruct the truck parking area, and we've reviewed that with them. They had a couple minor comments on the cooperative agreement, and we're pretty much there on at least from the UDOT side.
So does that mean then that all of those trucks that would park there would now are now coming off the Pine Brook exit?
So no. The trucks will still access the truck parking area from the freeway. It'll separate right at there. We're providing 10 spots for trucks. That was UDOT's requirement, plus a parallel two parallel lanes that allow them to quickly drop their chains if they're coming over the Parleys and then take off. We'll also direct trucks to the Silver Creek truck stop that's there now. And UDOT, I think in the next few years, we'll be doing some improvements on the Silver Creek truck parking area. So,
but all of the vehicles that would use the park and ride lot then would be accessing
would
off of the Pine Brook exit.
From Pine Brook exit along Kilby, yes.
Yeah, okay. And so that means some widening? Is that what you're
anticipating?
So our
concept is to We will widen the road, but it will be for two things. One, we'll be building some right turn lanes in and out, and then left turn pockets. And we will also be adding a bike lane, whether it's shined and striped as a bike lane or whether it just be a wide shoulder like we have on Old Ranch or on some of our other roads. That's yet to be determined. It probably will be a bike lane. So it will be widened, but it'll still be single lane, eastbound, westbound. The capacity increase will just be because then we're able to move cars out of the through lane into a turn pocket. Creating the turn pockets also kind of create a curvilinear design so that it's not this straightaway. So we hope to keep speeds down a little bit with the curvilinear design.
And then with regard to the roundabouts at both, are we talking both Jeremy and the Pine Brook side?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And so to give us an idea of what that looks like, because does the roundabout come off of the interstate or is it the roundabout at the two, you know, the grocery store and the gas station exits?
Both. So
there'll be four?
No, there's two roundabouts. They're just very large. So probably twice as big as anything you've seen in the county. The off-ramps come into about the center of the roundabout. You break off and then turn. You start around and you can either then swing around off the – if you're eastbound on the Pine Brook side and you want to go to the Jeremy side, you just swing around the roundabout, go under the underpass, make a quick turn to wherever you're going to the school or to the neighborhood. The frontage roads also tie in to the same roundabout. It should function really well.
Okay. Just, yeah, so
yep.
Big.
Big.
Okay. And does that impact the bike lane and the pedestrian walkway that we have at all?
Nope. We're actually going to be improving pedestrian access. We've designed into the project two underpasses currently from the on and off ramp. We are working to try to fund the underpass under Kilby, and then basically people can get north to south without crossing any lanes of traffic. Currently, we are not planning a underpass of Pine Brook Boulevard or Homestead. We just don't have the funds. The terrain, they'll be very expensive to build because the terrain is not conducive. But we'll continue to work. If we can fund them, we'll build them.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Derek Radke is Summit County Public Works Director. The Utah Legislature well into its second week of business, and one of the biggest expenditures every budget year is education. In the studio with an update of how things are looking so far, I have Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Hauber. Good morning.
Good morning.
So before we kind of get into that, we had heard yesterday from outgoing board member Julie Eihausen that we should expect to see our taxes go up several hundred dollars over the next 3 years to pay for the staff increases. Will any of that be offset by what the legislature does this year?
Sure. So when we were putting the budget together, we had anticipated that because of staffing and the compensation agreements that were entered into, that we would be into a tax increase mode. And so that's not new to us. That's something that we had anticipated and looked out over a five-year time horizon to see what that would look like over that period. So, yeah, about $120 is what we're looking at this year on a home valued at $650,000, about $120 again the next year, and then maybe something closer to $40 in year three. So those are things we had anticipated we were looking at. Building that budget, we had also anticipated that the legislature would at least increase the WPU by 2.5%. Right now, the governor's recommendation is 5.5%. The School Boards Association recommendation is 5.5%, and the legislature's downplaying that a little bit, and they're talking in terms of 2%. I'm sure it will move up from the 2. So as long as we see the 2.5%, nothing changes on what we were forecasting on tax increase. If it's higher, obviously it would reduce that.
Sure. So that $650,000, is that total value, or is that the taxable value?
That's the market value.
So
total value.
So it would be even less. I mean, because we only pay 55% of that market value.
Oh, that's taken into account. So if your house is valued at 650, you get the 55, or you're taxed on 55% of that value, and then we go from there.
Okay, and that's what that 120.
Correct.
Equals?
Based on that method.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, last year, session was considered really a win for Utah students. We saw WPU spending boosted by 4%, also approving more than $60 million in ongoing funding to fund student growth. So, again, you'd mentioned the WPUs in terms anywhere between 2 and 5.5%.
Sure.
What are we talking about in terms of student growth? Will that also be absorbed?
So enrollment growth is proposed to be funded. That's everywhere already taken into account by the legislature, by the governor, in all the conversations. In our case, the forecast for our school district officially from the State Office of Education and the legislature is that we'd actually have a declined enrollment by 11 students, essentially flat. So, yes, there'll be money for enrollment growth, but in our particular case at this point, we probably won't see any of that money.
So this comes at a time when our schools now is ramping up its campaign. This advocacy group, as we've talked about, is basically collecting signatures to add an initiative to November's ballot, asking voters to approve an income and sales tax increase, which, if passed, would boost education funding by some $750 million per year. So do you think this is motivating lawmakers to do something big?
So that's a good question. The impression that we're getting right now is, knowing that the legislature is talking about a lower WPU number than what we all know can be funded and has been is being recommended by the governor, is that the Our Schools Now initiative may be dampening some of the willingness of the legislature to make money available through their process of tax increases and tax allocations. So in anticipation that Our Schools Now initiative will get all of the signatures necessary and it will show up on a ballot, it most likely will make it through that process. Well, that's $700,000 that the legislature doesn't have to identify. And so the increases into a WPU don't need to be pulled together in quite the same fashion in anticipation of outside revenue coming in.
So there's some fear, you think, from lawmakers that the initiative could be approved, huh?
There's talk, you know, and as you look at the money conversations going on, it looks like they're at least anticipating that scenario. There's possibility and probability, and we're still in that world. Yeah, it's possible. How probable is it? Not too sure.
And what, I mean, so assume that then they fund it at the lowest level, the WPU, and this doesn't pass, then we're really hurting, no?
That's a gamble. And so we'll see as the legislative process continues whether there are the risk takers or those that say, hey, regardless of what might be happening out in a public referendum, we need to do what's right for public education regardless. So we'll see what thoughts prevail.
Mm-hmm. And our schools now, I mean, I think the distribution formula is based on students, so Park City would see some windfall there?
Yes, we would. The formula is actually based on the WPU. So whatever the WPU calculation is for a school district, that's how the monies are then allocated to a district. And then at the district level, the language that I've seen proposes that the money be distributed into the schools on a per-student basis. So it's kind of a mix of formulas, the district at the WPU level, the schools at the student level. And, the school district would definitely be a beneficiary of that project.
Our equalization bill still being discussed, and of course this is something that Park City's always targeted.
Yes, we are. They were discussed yesterday, and not as bills, though. So Senator Stevenson and Senator Fillmore are members of the executive, or not the executive, but the Public Education Appropriations Subcommittee, and they had some time yesterday in committee to talk about equalization. The message back from the committee was, great, let's talk about it, but let's see a bill so we know what exactly you're talking about. So there's not pushback on the concept of equalization, just how is that going to happen? And without a bill, you can't have a productive conversation. So that was the message back to those two senators is, let's get it in writing so we can talk about it.
Yeah, and again, equalization, of course, is that we have students living in a district like Park City with high property values and more money to support education as opposed to where the property values are less. And the whole idea is to bring more equality to make sure that students' educations aren't penalized by where they live. But are we actually adding more money to this? Or again, I mean, because I think what Park City's problem has always been is just a shell game. It's just not adding any more money. It's just taking money from Park City, Wasatch School District, districts like that.
Yeah, so the equalization concepts right now are not to redistribute the monies that are already allocated. So this is looking at actually increasing property tax in order to identify the monies that could be redistributed across the state. So a high assessed district like ours has a taxing potential. And so they would like to step into that taxing potential, take some of those dollars that weren't going anywhere, they're still in the taxpayer's pocket, and then redirect those into those districts that have low assessed valuation.
Right. And you and I have talked about this. Would that bill require then those districts in those lower tax collecting areas require them to come up to some kind of minimum?
Sure. And that's where we want to see the details of the language. How exactly does that come about? How do you identify eligibility for that redistribution? Is it just that you have low assessed valuations, or is it, as proposed in the past, it's a combination of low assessed value and high tax effort, which means essentially what you're asking, you know, are you making an effort locally to then receive more dollars because you truly are up against your maximums and the public there in that community just cannot provide more funding.
Yeah. Have you seen, of course, a lot of our funding comes from, for programs, comes from the Ed Foundation. Have you seen any moves to try and limit that or
Absolutely
equalize
not.
That?
Yeah, that's not on anyone's radar. And I think that is such a protected area for communities that's not appropriate to require a community that's working among its own members in a private way to then try and make that a public dollar and have it redistributed. That wouldn't carry anywhere.
What about the need to attract and retain quality teachers? Of course, we know that we're just going to need more and more as we go along. Is there any effort there?
So those are discussions in supporting a higher increase in the value of the WPU, because those are the primary dollars that come through to support additional teaching as well as compensation considerations. So those are the arguments that we're making on the Hill, that we need to still address teacher shortage, teacher compensation, and the WPU is that vehicle.
Yeah. What about any changes to how we license teachers?
Yeah, so there's a bill out there. It's House Bill 46 under Representative Peterson, and he's carrying a bill that the State Board of Education is asking to have written that takes the licensure process today and modifies it and actually gets rid of a few options for individuals to come into the teaching profession. So there's a concept called a letter I know the initials, LOA, now I forgot what the A stands for, but it's a letter of authorization that allows an individual to come into the teaching ranks on condition that they will complete teacher licensing and get all the professional credentials in place that are needed. That idea would disappear under this legislation, so that path into the teaching profession would disappear. There's another one that hits a little closer to home for us, which is that under statute, a superintendent is required to have licensure unless the local school board asks the state board to waive that requirement. This bill removes that altogether so that a superintendent would not have to have licensure and there would not have to be a conversation with the state board about allowing a non-licensed individual to be a superintendent. So that, you know, here we are in a superintendent search and that kind of opens up the door a little wider as to the types of individuals who could come and be the head of school here.
And what's that licensure? As a teacher or
as an administrator? Yeah.
Okay. Anything on the performance and assessment of teachers?
I haven't seen anything yet. I'm sure there's something out there, but it hasn't hit my radar just yet.
And in terms of tax reform, I mean, because it sounds like lots is just being kind of held back, not knowing what the federal tax reform means for Utah.
Yeah, and you've hit right on it, is all of the analytical work's being done at the tax commission trying to determine what is that impact, having the deductions changed and how those flow through into the state tax code is a challenge. And so there are ideas that there would just be an across-the-board change, you know, get off the flat 5 and maybe make it 5.9 or 5.7%, or sorry, the other way, 4.9, 4.7%, just something that's just across the board. Don't get real technical. Don't try and target the impacts, or just leave it alone. And this is essentially more funding available to public education without the legislature having had to take any action. So it's interesting to see those debates now, but no clear direction.
Yeah. So what else are you keeping your eye on?
So there's a couple of administrative type bills that have caught our attention. One is House Bill 175. Representative Stratton wants to create an oversight committee. So this is an entity that, in his opinion, would increase transparency, efficiency, and accountability of local governments. And it gives authority to this oversight committee to actually overrule any administrative rules that a local government would make. So, for example, at a Park City school district, if we were to pass a policy and that there is some pushback or complaint about that policy, an individual could go and lodge a complaint with this oversight committee, who would then conduct an investigation and could overturn that school board policy by their authority. And so there's a challenge of, we have local representatives, we have local elected officials, and this other body could come in and disrupt the affairs of that local entity. So we're watching that to see if that gets any traction.
Does it have support? And what precipitated it? Something must have happened.
There's a couple of things that had come forward. One is that right now there's a body called the Administrative Rules Committee. So as state government and local government promulgate rules, the Administrative Rules Committee has the authority to look and see if that rule is in conformity with the statute that enacted or that allowed for a rule to be written. So kind of narrow, just, mm-hmm. we passed a law, now someone has to interpret the law and how it's going to be administered, and those rules have to be in conformity with the law. This oversight seems to step outside of that, is that administrative policy committee, our review committee, wasn't functioning well, and it needed to have more authority and more scope. So this oversight committee comes in and says, it's not just, is it in conformity with law? It's just, is this good practice? Is it transparent? Was it put together appropriately? And will it be helpful to the community? So scope broadening, as well as authority to actually go in and repeal. They just can say, that rule no longer applies.
It just seems to feel like it goes against everything that leaders have said they want, and that is to give local decision makers authority.
Local authority, exactly. And it's already in law that they can do these activities. So there's some skepticism about, is this helpful or hurtful? The good representative tried to convey it to school officials that with an oversight committee in place, it could reduce the number of pieces of legislation that come to the legislature. Often education legislation comes about because of a very local issue. Someone wasn't able to do this, or they were prevented from doing that. And so they didn't get satisfaction at the local level, so they get hold of their representative, and then it becomes a law implemented across the state. So on his side, he says, hey, we can get rid of all of that activity and have it run through an oversight committee, and it just never becomes legislation. It just is very specific to that locale.
What else are you looking at?
How much time do you got for me?
A couple more minutes.
So there's a House Bill 178, again, from Representative Stratton. This modifies powers of attorney. So there are situations in the state where a child is attending a school and their parents have to leave the state. And there's a very cumbersome process to get guardianship for that child so that they can stay in that area and finish out their high school career or continue going to school. So he's trying to streamline that process through a power of attorney that allows for the parents to leave and give guardianship through a more streamlined legal process so the student can stay and continue at the school that they were already attending. So that one we see as a positive opportunity. It helps families with their individual situations. There's another one, Senate Bill 87. This is from Senator Wyler. He's looking at school security locks. So under the International Building Code and International Fire Code, there are certain locking mechanisms that cannot be used for lockdown situations. And some of those are actually preferred. And so he's trying to create legislation that would allow for some flexibility. It's not required, but allows flexibility that if a school district determines that this type of locking system is the best for their schools, then those codes are modified to allow for that locking system to be put in place. So interesting, we're talking a lot about security here, so that gives us an opportunity to look at other systems that may be better for our schools.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I'll stop there and, okay. and save the rest for another day.
Okay. Hey, Todd, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
That's Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Halber. It's 8:47. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. The Egyptian Theater presenting The Drifters this weekend, February 1st through the 4th. On the phone to tell us more about it, I have the Director of Operations and Programming for the Egyptian Theater, Amber Hansen. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so The Drifters, of course, the hit favorite, Stand By Me, Under the Boardwalk. Are we talking like some of the original members of The Drifters?
No. The original Drifters were formed in 1953, and it's really always been about who was managing The Drifters, because there's been a lot of band members coming and going throughout the years. So George Treadwell was the Grammy-winning producer of The Drifters, who formed The Drifters, and they've had a lot of really good lead singers over the years, Hall of Fame members like Benny King and people like that. But the Treadwell family got together probably about 15 years ago to form the Drifters group again to tour. So it's really always been about who's owned the Drifters and the music to the Drifters, and that's been the producer. So this group has been the Drifters well over 10 years, and they put on a great show, but as far as the original members of the Drifters, it's been 50 years since the originals were the Drifters.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, but the music and the, is all the same, huh?
Oh, yeah. And we had them about this time of year 2 years ago. They packed the house and put on a really amazing performance. It's just high energy, all the songs you love. I mean, they put on a great show. So it's really... It's just really a show to see.
Okay, so I mentioned the 1st through the 4th, 8 p.m., except for the Sunday show?
Yeah, Sunday's at 6 p.m., and as far as tickets go, Sunday is the best bet. We're pretty much sold out Thursday, Friday, Saturday, but if you're not a football fan, Sunday night is the night to go.
Ah, yeah, okay. And tell us what else you got coming up.
Next weekend, the 7th through the 11th, we added a night because Howard Jones, his solo piano stories tour, sold out really well. We added a night on the 7th, and that show's pretty much sold out, so we're just taking a wait list now. Then we'll have Chubby Checker, another blast from the past, and again, he is the original Chubby Checker. He'll be performing 15th through the 18th, and then at the end of the month, we'll have an evening with Paula Cole.
Okay. All right, parkcityshows.com or the box office, 649-9371?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, that's it. So like I said, if you want to see the Drifters Thursday through Saturday, call now because we're very limited on seating, but Sunday we have great seats available.
All right. Thanks, Amber.
Thank you.
Well, Summit County resident Margaret Bowman will be honored by the Salt Lake City National Weather Service with what is called the Home Award. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Margaret.
This is Margaret.
Hi, Margaret. So tell us what you've been doing for the National Weather Service for the last 30 years.
Well, just taking their weather and the ups and downs of it. When it snowed, I'd measure it. And... I don't know, just doing it every day. I never thought that it was anything extra special, But it's been interesting, to see what happened, with the weather and all. And I said on that last interview, one thing that always sticks in my mind, there was one day that it was 24 below zero. And I remember that one. I don't remember very much of anything, but
that one you do. Yeah. So, do you have your own little weather station in your yard or something?
First they had it over by. We've got some big gas tanks there, and they had it there. And then eventually, she had put it up so that it come, into the house. And once a month, I'd have to walk across to a little station they'd put up on the fence. And send it, back into them.
Okay. So how did you get into this?
Well, as far as I can remember, one of the neighbors had it and then didn't want to continue, and so he passed it on to another neighbor, and then that neighbor asked Tiny if he'd, you know, do it. And so he said yes, but it ended up Margaret doing it mostly.
Yeah. Well, so how did you do it for 30 years? I mean, were you able to take a vacation at all? I mean, if you weren't there.
Oh, yes. Yeah. If I wasn't here and I couldn't find somebody, I'd just have to miss it. You know, I had papers that I had to mail in once a month. And so if I couldn't find someone to do it, I'd just have to miss it for the time that we were gone.
Okay. And so what was it that you were measuring? Temperature and precipitation? Anything else?
Yes. I was thinking last night, he was asking something else, and she said, no, we didn't have. Oh, I think it was the wind that she was asking about, and we didn't have anything to do with that.
Okay. Why is it important that the National Weather Service has people like you willing to do this? I mean, this is what they base, I guess, their records on, huh?
I don't know really how it all got started, and that we're just a little rural community. Takes 20 minutes from up here from Colville, and so we just try to do what we can to help everybody, you know.
It takes 20 minutes to actually do the reporting, or just?
No, 20 minutes to drive from Colville up to where I live.
Oh, okay. But in terms of what it meant on a daily basis, just a couple of minutes to check the report and write it down?
Yes, 10 minutes, something like that.
Yeah. So have they found your successor?
Well, they thought that they had one, and then I understand that he's changed his mind, so I don't know if they've got anyone else, you know, lined up or not.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, again, the award comes to you on Friday. They're actually coming to your house. That's nice of them.
Yes.
At least they can do. Yeah, well, congratulations, and thanks for your dedicated service.
Oh, well, it's just something I just did, and I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed seeing the difference in weather and that, and it didn't take me that long to do it.
Yeah, but you've just had enough, huh? You said 30 years, and it's someone else's turn.
I had fallen, and it was really hard for me to get around, and that was when I decided, you know, that I had to give it up. Especially from just, it was once a month, but from my back patio over to where they had this little machine on the thing, if it snowed, I had to, you know, shovel the snow out and to get to it and that. And I just decided, you know, it was about time to quit. One of my son-in-laws said, haven't you been taking that weather a long time? Isn't that time for you to give it up? You know, but I've enjoyed it.
Oh, good. Yeah, gives you some purpose. Well, again, congratulations, and thanks for your time this morning, Margaret.
All right. Thank you.
Margaret Bowman, again, will be honored by the Salt Lake City National Weather Service with the Holm Award on Friday afternoon. KPCW News Time now, 8:57.
Programming for KPCW is sponsored in part by Mark Wangsgard and Jim Doilney of Retail at New Park, part of the development team of New Park Town Center and co-owners of the New Park Sun Plaza, location of many Park City community events.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Hospital, a not-for-profit community hospital supporting KPCW. While you may never need to outrun a cheetah, the sports performance team at Park City Hospital can help you do so using our new high-speed treadmill. Whether you're an elite athlete or just looking to better your PR, our team of experts will help you run faster, get stronger, and increase your agility. The high-speed treadmill is designed to go up to 31 miles an hour, allowing you to outrun and outlast the competition. And cheetahs. Call 435-658-7350 to book a session.
The Sundance Institute has announced the winner of its first ever Festival Favorite Award. The votes gathered.